Kalorama, a Recorded Books/Highbridge imprint presents Taming the Octopus, The Long Battle for the Soul of the Corporation by Kyle Edward Williams, read by John Vertullo. A corporation has no natural existence, and therefore has no natural or inalienable rights such as natural persons have. The difference is broad and well marked between the natural man and the artificial person. God made man, and men make governments, while the government creates the corporations. Tom Brown, Southern Mercury, 1890. If anything is certain to destroy our free society, to undermine its very foundations, it would be a widespread acceptance by management of social responsibilities in some sense other than to make as much money as possible. This is a fundamentally subversive doctrine. Milton Friedman, Academic Seminar, 1958. Stakeholder capitalism is not about politics. It is not a social or ideological agenda. It is not woke. It is capitalism. Larry Fink, BlackRock Letter to CEOs, 2022. Introduction. What is the corporation good for? Its sucker-lined tentacles reach across vast expanses of an eastern United States, darkened by ominous rain clouds, the tentacles winding and tightening around the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., a state legislative house, cargo ships, and the gasping figures of industrial bosses. Its reach stretches beyond the ocean to parts unknown, ensnaring oil derricks, refineries, and railroads. The red-eyed octopus bears a name across its head, figured as a colossal storage tank: Standard Oil. Readers who picked up the weekly humor magazine Puck in early September of 1904, perhaps stealing a brief respite after a long shift on a production line, came across this striking lithograph in the centerfold. The magazine satirized and skewered corruption wherever it could be found, and there was no greater symbol of the abuse of economic power than Standard Oil, the monopolistic giant that had dominated the petroleum industry for decades and was poised to move into the newly discovered oil fields of the Southwest. Puck was the largest magazine of its kind, and each week, more than 90,000 subscribers, and many thousands of others who borrowed copies from friends and neighbors or bought it at newsstands, waited eagerly to see who the progressive cartoonists would target next. One newspaper editor at the time observed that there was no corner in the land in which the magazine did not exert its influence. The same could be said of the Octopus. This wasn't the first time that the octopus was invoked to describe a corrupt and powerful corporation. The novelist and muckraking journalist Frank Norris used the imagery to great effect in his 1901 novel, The Octopus, A Story of California, which told of the battle between farmers in the San Joaquin Valley and a powerful railroad that took possession of their lands and ruined their fortunes. A few decades earlier, Joseph Potts, a petroleum industrialist, said that the Standard Oil Trust's purchase of his competitors pushed them, shivering with dislike, into the embrace of this commercial octopus. Calling John D. Rockefeller's monopoly an octopus wasn't just an insult. The image conveyed what everyone already knew, that the company had its hands in everything, in railroads, pipelines, refining, consumer marketing, not to mention the boardrooms of transportation companies, the halls of state legislatures, and the offices of newspapers. In Scandinavian folklore, colossal octopus-like beasts known as kraken come up from the ocean depths to overtake ships. English sailors sometimes called them bloodsuckers. Spineless and feral, it was an animal whose 19th-century depictions made it out to be extremely clever, intelligent, and capable of obscuring itself with billowy ink. Americans have long been conflicted, confused, and often anxious about the entity known as the corporation. Frequently infatuated with the power and size of big business, Americans have also been deeply fearful and suspicious of it. The Founding Fathers associated corporations with the abuses of the British Crown, which is one reason they gave neither Congress nor the executive the power to incorporate, leaving this duty to the states. James Madison expressed a peculiarly American attitude about corporations most succinctly when he wrote to a friend in 1827 that they may be useful, but they are at best a necessary evil only. It is difficult to overstate the degree to which the rise of large corporations provoked a crisis in American life. Beginning first with the railroad and communications industries in the 1870s, and then encompassing industries from cigarettes to cars, these concentrations of capital and employment, thriving on vertical integration and technological innovations, shook up everything that Americans had known about the economy. New industrial corporations remade capitalism, and the ramifications of the U.S. Supreme Court's 1886 Santa Clara County decision, which extended constitutional protections for corporate persons, became more widely known at the turn of the century. Corporate personhood itself evoked the freakish. The New York Times quipped, "A corporation has neither a body that can be kicked nor a soul that can be sent to perdition." Economist John R. Commons would later imagine unkickable bodies and undammable souls. "While the corporation has no soul," he wrote, "yet it has a mysterious will somewhere that acts like a soul." The year after Puck ran its famous cartoon, the federal government opened an investigation into Standard Oil because of the trust's monopolistic practices that provoked a conflict known as the Kansas Oil War. Doubtless with an octopus in mind, one governor in 1905 implored his fellow progressives to take the monster, the Standard Oil Trust, by the neck and compel it to be decent. In different guises over the past century and more, the corporate monster has been an object of fascination and populist repulsion, and it still haunts our political culture. When journalist Matt Taibbi took stock of the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 in the pages of Rolling Stone, he called Goldman Sachs a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. In recent years, however, business leaders have come to believe that what James Madison thought was a necessary evil is actually the last great institution capable of making the world a better place. For Silicon Valley entrepreneurs no less than Fortune 500 CEOs, a shift has occurred. The bottom line is out, and changing the world is in. Call it conscious capitalism, or shared value, or corporate social responsibility. Many consumers, regulators, and activists expect big business executives to act like good, responsible citizens and steer their firms accordingly, maybe more now than ever before. And many leading executives are more than willing to heed the call. That has meant taking public stands on controversial issues. At Starbucks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Amazon, and other major companies, executives have expressed opposition to the overturning of Roe v. Wade by implementing policies that cover travel expenses for employees seeking abortions. I understand the anxiety and concern that many of you and your families may be feeling at this moment, PayPal's CEO Dan Schulman wrote to workers. I want to be clear. Caring for our employees is our highest priority. In the days after the 2020 election, a group of about 30 chief executives from Walmart, Goldman Sachs, Johnson & Johnson, and other firms organized a response to Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election results. Nike, meanwhile, has celebrated its programs for young women's empowerment in the developing world and supported Colin Kaepernick's protest against police violence. Executives at Whole Foods, bought by Amazon in 2017, tout their firm's support for a virtuous circle entwining the food chain, human beings, and Mother Earth. And more Wall Street banks are taking environmental, social, and governance, ESG, standards and rankings into account for their investment strategies, which has trickled down to business valuations and, increasingly, managerial strategy. According to a recent survey, 92% of executives agree that corporate leaders should take a stand on social issues. And although activists tend to be suspicious of corporate America, many on the political left have cautiously welcomed this business support for progressive causes. Companies are obligated to use their voice and influence when core principles of democracy are threatened, wrote Sherrilyn Ifill, then president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. But for every liberal or progressive who sees corporate social commitments as steps toward a better world, there are perhaps just as many conservatives who think the CEOs have taken flight from reason and forgotten who butters their bread. When a supposedly radicalized management mandates training against racism for its employees, for example, it is implementing a program of soft totalitarianism. And by exchanging business sense for social change, corporations are undermining free enterprise. Corporate power has increasingly been utilized to impose an ideological agenda on the American people, said Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Woke capital, to use a phrase coined by New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, has taken over corporate America. The problem, as conservatives see it, is that market actors are not acting like the profit-seeking agents they should be. They are letting other motivations, the expectations of the cultural elite or the desire for popular approval or even social control, make them negligent of their actual duties. And all of this to the peril of our economy. At the surface, we see efforts to make corporations align with one side's values, whether progressive or conservative. But a deeper understanding of this corporate culture war reveals underlying assumptions that each side makes about the corporation. It is further confused by the rhetoric of many executives and management gurus. Critics of corporate power often decry superficial public relations or outright cynicism in corporations that parrot the rhetoric of social responsibility. Corporate leaders make merely cosmetic changes or vague future promises, critics conclude, about working conditions, environmental responsibility, and product safety. When it comes to the way big business actually does business, fleeting expectations and Aquarian rhetoric have outpaced prospects for real change. Don't be evil isn't just an abandoned slogan of Google. It is a diversion from difficult questions about power, responsibility, and democratic expectations. Only by understanding what a corporation is and what it is good for can we begin to make our way out of this conflict, or at least to know where genuine disagreements lie. The corporation is no longer novel or freakish to us in the way that it was to the generations that first called it the octopus. But populist anxieties about corporate threats to democracy and to the American people stubbornly persist. The history of corporate social responsibility is a story of the struggle on the part of activists, executives, regulators, and others to make this institution accountable, to domesticate the very thing that many doubted was even capable of being domesticated. But accountable to whom or to what? That is the question driving this book, which examines the history of corporate power and social responsibility from the bottom up and the top down. Because how we think about the purpose of business is inseparable from how we have decided to govern our economic institutions. This book investigates the origins and meaning of academic theories, legal constructs, and political concepts that have shaped the history of the corporation in the modern United States. It weaves these ideas into the stories of business people, employees, consumers, and activists who have waged battles over business decisions, managerial strategies, and public policy, and who have sometimes fought for roads not taken. At the center of this story is the large, publicly traded corporation, and not primarily smaller businesses or closely held firms, because this institution has done more to fashion American life than has any other kind of business. For this is also a story about the modern form of corporation, a legal person who has been created again and again by state legislatures since the early years of the American Republic. 200 years ago or so, those legislatures made sure to judge whether it was necessary for a new corporation to be created, for what purpose, and for how long. This deliberation mattered because the corporation was granted special privileges that allowed it to amass capital and to be covered in legal protections that no one else enjoyed. By the end of the 19th century, the legal process for making a new corporation had become routine, more like opening a checking account than something esoteric like asking the government to create a new legal person. It's still the case that no corporation exists without a state making it so, meaning large, publicly traded corporations are still concessions of the power of government. But we have almost entirely forgotten this history. When seen in a new light, the strangeness of this seemingly familiar institution is made clearer and suggests rethinking what we thought we knew about the corporation's relationship to democracy and to the common good. In order to understand how this peculiar legal form became an unstoppable dynamo of business power, its tentacles wrapped around the globe many times over, we have to go back 100 years or so, to a time we now know as the Progressive Era. 1. The New Princes of Industry. Would Theodore Roosevelt rise to the occasion? He was mistakenly known at the time, and still is remembered today, as Trust-Busting T.R., Rough Rider turned scourge of the monopolists. But the real story is more complicated. As president, he set about steering corporate power through a series of gentlemen's agreements. Not content with nudging or influencing corporations from the outside, he wanted the federal government to reach inside firms and set the standard for what corporations should do and what responsibilities they should have. "We do not wish to destroy corporations," Roosevelt said in 1902, "but we do wish to make them subserve the public good." Far from a trust buster, T.R. was a trust musterer who wanted to enroll big business into a progressive partnership with the executive branch. In 1907, a wrenching financial panic caused the New York Stock Exchange to teeter on the edge of collapse. Although far more centered on the lending houses of Wall Street, the panic seemed to be an ominous sign that the post-Civil War era that had been punctuated by damaging financial crises in 1873, 1893, 1896, and now 1907, stubbornly refused to come to an end. Roosevelt responded to the 1907 crisis in part by pushing for legislation that would rein in large corporations written by members of a progressive lobbying organization called the National Civic Federation, NCF, the bill would have established a formal process of federal licensing, charters, and transparency. Is it not time that we go further and bring these great corporations under control? Asked progressive economist Jeremiah Jenks at one of the group's major conferences. Much like laws that regulated food, such as the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, which prohibited interstate transport of adulterated or mislabeled food, such policies would benefit industry, Roosevelt insisted, by providing national standards. Effectively, Roosevelt argued for the regulation of business for the benefit of business. The following year, Republican U.S. Representative William Hepburn introduced the bill in Congress. The original drafts, written by Jenks, former mayor of New York City Seth Lowe, and other NCF members, envisioned a voluntary system in which corporations might register with the federal government. Participating firms would regularly submit financial statements and internal information and provide access to books, records, including contracts and agreements, and accounts. There was a progressive form of a quid pro quo that underwrote this idea. Compliance with supervision by the Bureau of Corporations provided the guarantee that the Department of Justice would not pursue antitrust action against a compliant corporation. As Roosevelt's allies further revised the proposed legislation, they gave the executive branch incredible power over the new corporate order. By establishing constant administrative oversight by means of close consultation and cooperation with corporate managers, this legislation would have transformed them into well-paid public servants rather than old-style capitalists. It's a remarkable fact that the Hepburn Bill was the first and only legislation endorsed by a president that was premised on the theory that corporations are not private institutions, and that the internal governance of the corporation should reflect that. TR gave voice to the impulse, strong among populists, radicals, and many progressives, that democratic interests ought to govern the economy and, especially, corporate institutions. The proposal would have brought the corporate system under the power of popular politics, granting the president power to regulate and control all corporation business of the country, the New York Times pointed out. As such, the bill earned the near universal opposition of business groups, both large and small, and never made it out of committee. It expresses, however, one important way Americans tried to square corporate power with democratic expectations, by treating corporations as if they were governmental institutions possessing rights and responsibilities subject to political supervision. The rise of corporate capitalism at the beginning of the 20th century fueled the fires of 1,000 social movements. Whether feminist or labor unionist, populist or socialist or progressive, all of them tried to reckon with a far from bloodless revolution that left almost nothing in American society and politics untouched. People at the time called it the trust question, a term evoking doubts about the trustworthiness of new social institutions, while at the same time invoking the financial trusts, which were only the most visible and scandalous of the new economic behemoths. But no single phrase could plausibly represent the size and scope of this menacing tumult. The Puck cartoon of the Standard Oil octopus evoked not only the grotesque and the wily, but also the vital dynamism, the sheer energetic potential of these new institutions. In the early 20th century, Americans began to exchange a long-held anxiety about corporate power for an ambivalent, if unsteady, admiration. It's not that the anxiety entirely disappeared. Rather, the advantages of corporate capitalism left few untouched. Middle-class professionals, the rising ranks of consumers, unionized workers, Wall Street financiers, imperialist political leaders, even those radical farmers from the South and Midwest whose cash crops made it to world markets only by way of railroads. As the GNP grew from $17.4 billion to $103.1 billion between 1899 and 1929, mostly due to the rapid growth of vertically integrated firms such as American Tobacco or Standard Oil before it was broken up by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1911, most social groups came around to the idea that there was something useful, if still at times dangerous, about the corporation. And for those who suspected that they had something to gain from allowing the corporate form of business to be dynamic and more or less free from political control, a rising group of business executives proposed that a new style of leadership, as yet untried, and not structural change, could reconcile the corporation with democratic expectations. Gerard Swope was one such business leader. Gerard was born into a lower-middle-class immigrant family in St. Louis, Missouri. His father, Isaac, so taciturn that his friends sometimes called him Silent Swope, started a small business, making watches, and his mother, Ida, took care of the children. Gerard Swope was educated at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, then got a job in Chicago with the Western Electric Company, a manufacturing firm that would soon be bought up by AT&T. It was there in Chicago that Swope rose through the ranks of the engineering department in the late 1890s, during a time when he was living at Jane Addams's Hull House, a so-called settlement house that sought to serve the urban working class. He taught evening classes to workers and became acquainted with a range of social reformers such as Julia Lathrop, soon to be head of the Children's Bureau of the Department of Labor, and Florence Kelly, dominating influence behind the Consumers League of New York City. Swope made a hasty ascent to the top. He became a vice president and director at Western Electric, and after World War I, president of the international arm of the General Electric Company, GE, and, in 1922, president of the company itself. By that time, GE was making light bulbs, electrical transformers and sockets, radios and other products of the early electric age. Swope was appointed president of GE at the same time that his colleague, Owen D. Young, was made the new chairman. This new leadership pair boosted GE's market share, but their most innovative contributions came in the area of industrial relations. Their main tool? Workers' councils, otherwise known as company unions, aimed at facilitating reconciliation between labor and management within the firm itself. The pair initiated a revolution in GE's industrial relations by pioneering what some scholars have called welfare capitalism: higher wages, profit sharing, insurance, various educational and social benefits, and pensions. Even such critics as Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens, progressives who had made a name for themselves decades earlier as muckrakers who focused on abuses by big business through their exposés of Standard Oil and municipal governments, now celebrated this movement of enlightened business leadership. Tarbell, who published a biography of Young in 1932, declared him a new type of industrial leader. It was universally agreed, Tarbell asserted, that there was no such thing as private business any longer. Industry is learning that as power increases, so does responsibility. In speeches and pamphlets throughout the 1920s and early 1930s, the GE duo explained their philosophy to colleagues and the public. In the pulpit of New York City's Park Avenue Baptist Church in 1929.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?